Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
Are we all ready to go?
Yeah.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Polycast episode 436. I'm Canis Albinus, and I'm joined with Makalua.
Sometimes I need a knockout pill instead of a wake-up pill.
And Mega Bears fan.
And sometimes I need to not stay up till 2 a.m. playing games and then get up at 8:30 in the morning to do podcasts.
Ah, this was easier when I was like 10 years younger.
Oh, for sure. Cue the lethal weapon, I'm too old for this.
Oh, I'm not saying it. Don't say it. Don't say it.
Yeah, it's we like don't want to curse. We don't have to. We don't want to have to do censorship.
Well, just don't invoke the curse of saying that.
Stuff. He said stuff.
And things.
Let's head into the news.
Well, speaking of stuff and things, but, you know, more fun stuff and things. Eagle Pursuit over on Sim Fanatics has a post where he said he's going to do a retrospective on series one game at a time. So far, he's up to Civ 3. He's got it all over on YouTube. And each time he's talking about which innovations for each game. Like, the original Civilization, there might have been other games with the tech tree before that, or at least, I don't know. I would honestly have to look that up.
These are short, too. These videos are like a minute and a half long each.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These aren't actually made by Eagle Pursuit. They're actually made by Firaxis.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood that.
He's just posting them here.
Yeah. My apologies. The way I read that, see, this is why I need more caffeine, because I totally read that like he made them. But he's posting the ones that Firaxis are posting, and they're talking about what was innovative on each time. But only a minute long. That's not very long. I know they like to use, I know that these days it's all bite-sized shorts of things, but you know, you could go to at least 5 minutes.
Well, they're a minute and a half long, so they don't quite qualify as,
Well, yeah, they're not a technical short, but they're a very short form, you know, attention span things.
Yeah. I thought their videos were pretty interesting, although, they showed things that don't exist in the game anymore a lot. So it's like, well, what? Why are you showing us these cool things that we don't have anymore? Like High Council and...
Well, the innovation was getting rid of them, apparently.
And the colony that they showed in the third Civ 3 video.
Yeah, why are you reminding me of these things that I wish we still had? Huh?
Well, I mean, maybe it's a, like, hint, hint, wink, wink of what might be to come. Who knows?
That maybe they've remixed a bunch of stuff from previous games into the new game?
Yeah, maybe they're trying to get us excited for old things that are coming back.
Well, it'd be more exciting if I didn't have to wait until August to see gameplay.
Well, August will be here before we know it.
Yeah, it is July already.
Yeah, because it's already July, but still. It's me being short attention span. Want it now!
Well, we all want Civ 7 now.
Well, if you are, a little too anxious for Civ 7 and need to get some 4X gaming in right now, there is a new DLC for Old World that is releasing soon or has already released. What was the date for this?
It released on May 28th.
Okay, so this has been out for over a month now. So Behind the Throne has been released for Old World, which adds a bunch of new characters, events, projects, and some new gameplay mechanics. And also apparently pushes the game into later political eras. Like the trailer looks like it shows like a medieval king. So it looks like they might actually be pushing the game forward in time, because my recollection was it was like classical, like ancient Greece kind of stuff originally. So
yeah, like Roman antiquity stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's like ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, those sorts of kind of cultures, and now maybe they're getting a little more medieval. And interesting to see that apparently one of the designers for the game is actually a member on the Civ Fanatics forums. He actually posted on this thread.
Yeah, Dale. Actually, there's quite a few of the Mohawk Games people who are former Apolliton and Civ Fanatics Civ players. Like, you've got Solver, who has appeared on Polycast many, many years ago. And Dale did one of the scenarios in Civilization IV Beyond the Sword. He did the Road to War World War II mod, which was really good. And there are other Mohawk developers in here as well. There's Fluffy Bunny Mohawk, who is a QA designer or worker there. So a lot of the members from Mohawk Games came from the Civ community, which is probably why the game is so good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of developers and designers who are currently at other studios making new strategy games who are longtime veterans of Civilization forums.
There's several of them, I know that.
And I'm sure there's a lot more that we don't even, you know who they are, necessarily. Anyway, I don't know, did either of you ever play Old World? I know I only played a little bit of it, so I'm not super qualified to talk about it all that much, but...
I
haven't, because I think it was, wasn't it originally out on Epic only?
I think it was, but it's on Steam now, so...
Okay.
I picked it up when it came out on Steam, but I only played it for like a week or two before, you know, going on to other things and falling off of it.
I have intended to play it for a while, but there are a lot of things going on in my life that kind of preclude me from playing a lot of video games right now, so most of my time is spent with Civ and Elden Ring right now.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I stopped playing it for a while because, like, some other game came out, probably a From Software game. And it's almost kind of like a paradox game in that when it came time where I was thinking of going back to it, I felt like I probably needed to go through the tutorial again to, like, relearn how to play the game. Because it's, you know, it's very similar to Civ, but also a lot different because there's, because it's got a lot more focused time period. It's got a lot more complicated, you know, nuanced things going on that are specific to that time period. And I didn't feel at the time like going back through the tutorial again, but also didn't feel like trying to, you know, start an actual game or continue a game because I was afraid I didn't, you know, wouldn't know how to play anymore. And because of that, I kind of never got around to going back to it at all, even though it has remained installed on my computer. And in fact, when I got my new computer last fall, in order to play Cities Skylines 2, I installed it on that one too, with the intent of playing it, and just still haven't gotten around to it. There's just too many games competing for attention now.
Yeah, it's been a good year for games.
It's been a good few years. And I mean, I've been playing the heck out of the PS5. Like, I think that might be my second favorite gaming console of all time at this point, after the PlayStation 2.
Best part of PlayStation 2 is you can play PS2 games on your PC now, because emulators are a thing. But you have to make sure that you actually have a PS2 to do it, otherwise you're breaking the law. So
I do still have both a working PS2 and a working backwards compatible PS3, so I believe I am good in that regard.
Good.
But, you know, for how long those will last, who knows? Apparently, I was reading something that Sony might be making the PS5, like, backwards compatible with PS3 discs, which would basically turn my PS3 into a PS2.
Well, that might be true, but there's also a lot of PS5s that don't have disc slots, so...
True, yeah. So my thinking for that was they're probably going to be releasing more PS3 digital games on PS5, but who knows, we'll see.
We'll see. Okay, so our next topic is kind of one that is a little bit worrisome for those of us who love games like Civ, but Quantic Foundry, which is what are they? They are, I don't actually know what they are, but I think they do research, but they did.
I think they specifically do research on video games and player behavior.
Okay. They have released a report that suggests that video game enjoyers, i.e. gamers and, you know, people who are in our demographic, have become less interested in strategic planning and thinking over the last 9 years. And they talk about how the appeal of strategy titles in general have substantially declined from like 50% to 35%, according to their data. And it's the equivalent, like they say, how big of a drop is this? It's the equivalent of all men plus 20 in the U.S. losing 17 pounds in weight. So
that's like a weird weird metaphor.
I like the metaphor they have. It says, a good metaphor for strategy is the size of the whiteboard in your mind that each decision is taking to map out, which attention spans and how much room we have for other things in our lives right now. You know, just saying this on the last topic, we only have so much time and so many games, and this is the same thing. People want something that they can enjoy. They can sit down and they can have like 2 or 3 hours and go on to something else. Or, you know, smaller chunks of gaming and lighter chunks of gaming, because strategy does require a lot of thinking.
Yeah, I have a few things to say about this. First and foremost is I don't recall that seeing anything in any of these articles, including the original one, the original source, that specifies like a reason why they think this might be happening. Of course, I think the go-to reason that everyone is probably thinking in their heads is, you know, millennials and Gen Z have shorter attention spans. They don't want to play long, complicated strategy games. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. Also, like, this is a self-report survey. From what I can tell from looking through this, they're not, like, combing through, like, Steam data and, you know, doing, like, a really, you know, rigorous scientific approach. So it could be something where, like, maybe this survey, because I had never heard of this survey until now. So maybe this survey is, you know, being more easily found by people who are using, like, social media a lot already, which might be people who are more likely to have shorter attention spans and be less interested in long-term engagement. Or it could be that maybe it's showing up on forums and accounts that are related to other types of games, so those are being over-reported. Or it could be that they have this like these 12 different categories of what do they call it, gamer motivations. So it could be that maybe those are kind of have fuzzy definitions. And maybe people are associating things that they like about strategy games with other motivations, right? Like maybe, you know, for example, like if I were to take this survey, I haven't taken it. I did queue it up in a tab so that I could take it after the show's over. So I could hopefully give some strategy games a few more points here. Maybe you too should as well if you haven't already. But like, so they have one of these gamer motivations is discovery, right? So, you know, one of my favorite things about Civilization and 4X games more generally is that early game period of exploring the map, right? Which is something that I would qualify as discovery, right? So could it be that maybe the kind of people who like play like the first half of a Civ game and then get bored and then re-roll to start a new map are maybe not saying they like strategy, but are saying they like discovery, right? Does that make sense? Like maybe it's stuff like that too.
It might also be that there's just fewer strategy games overall compared to other games.
Well, compared to over games, other games, sure. But there is also the fact that, like, if you do look at, like, Steam data, for instance, like, the last 10 to 15 years, which is when most of this decline is being seen by this group, like, we've had an explosion in certain types of strategy games. Like, for example, the, like, medieval village builder, right, that, like, started with Banished back around, like, I want to say, like, what, 2008, 2009, somewhere in there?
Somewhere in that,
like,
area.
Like, look at Steam and look at how many medieval city builders there are now. Now, would those be classified by this group as strategy? Or would they be more, you know, management, you know, building kind of games, right? Like, where do those lie? And then we're seeing now almost a renaissance in 4X gaming, right? It used to be Civ was the only dog in town. And now, you know, we've got Humankind, we've got Old World, we've got Aura coming up, we've got Millennia just released, you know, we've got all kinds of Space 4Xs, you know, we've got Stellaris, we've got Endless Space. So I actually, it feels to me like there's more strategy games now than there were, but that could just be me.
There are more, but there's also a much larger pool of games also. So,
oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, as I was hinting at earlier, like, there are too many games and not enough time to play them. And that does particularly hurt strategy games because they take so long to play and so long to get into. I mean, my story about how I fell off of Old World, right, could be a perfect example of this effect in action.
There's a secondary explanation that's noted, but it's not listed highly in the article, but it says that because the world is generally, because they're claiming that because the world is generally less happy than it was 10 years ago, that might have something to do with it, because, you know, the social media and persistent cognitive overload of negativity and polarization and intrusiveness and emotional manipulation may have people just worn out and too tired to think about things deeply.
That's where I was trying to get to earlier, is we all have, so even no matter what generation you're in, we all have so much more on our plates and bigger things to think about, that setting aside the time for gaming, we want something a little more escapist and not just as much real world, air quote, as a strategy, a 4X strategy game is.
Yeah. I would not be surprised at all to see an almost inverse relation with the so-called chill games. You know, your Harvest Moons, your Animal Crossings. Yeah, Stardew Valley, games like that, that are, you know, No Man's Sky, you know, people just chill and look at the scenery, right? And then go to a new planet and chill and look at the scenery. I wouldn't be surprised to see an inverse relation with that sort of game as well, for the same reasons that you mentioned.
I don't like that explanation, mostly because, with the exception of a few places in the world that have gone to war since the strategy has started, life quality, with the exception of the pandemic era, has generally gone up, mostly. Like, technology is getting better, poverty is going down. Yes, in America, there's a lot of polarization, but the rest of the world is also affected the same way, and most of the rest of the world is not dealing with the kind of political nonsense that we're dealing with here in America, so...
Well, there's a lot of it in Europe, too. But there's also, because of social media and stuff like that, people are, and because of, you know, 24-hour news cycles that started in, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, there's a lot more awareness of the bad things that are going on around the world. So even if they're not happening as often as they used to, or, in fact, might even be happening less, you know, things like war and starvation and stuff like that, people are more aware of it now because we see more of it. So that could also have an effect on people's perception of, you know, generally how, you know, life is on planet Earth.
Yeah, and our political problems here do affect other countries. So other people in other countries are watching us right now and going, please be sensible, you know, you know, don't cause craziness again. So
I think we're all thinking that right now.
Yes. But from the outside, they're also thinking that. And it doesn't mean they don't have their own sort of political problems in their own country. Nobody has great politics.
But I do, in general, find it a little bit difficult to reconcile that there is a general decline in interest in strategy games at the exact same time that there has been an explosion in, as I said before, that particular style of strategy management games that is, you know, exemplified by the rise of the medieval city builder.
Yeah, or the different flavors of Paradox games. Those are all grand strategy type things. You're putting a lot of hours in those.
I'm not saying that one disproves the other. I'm just saying I find it difficult to reconcile. More investigation is needed.
Or maybe just a little bit more disclosure on the part of this survey as to what games they're considering high on the strategy list.
Yeah, they give a few examples, and I saw something somewhere that gave a definition of what they consider to be the strategy motivation.
Defined as the appeal of long-term thinking, planning, and careful decision-making.
And they cite Europa Universalis and Total War, and then contrast that with Just Dance and Animal Crossing being on the other end of the that spectrum.
But that doesn't tell us anything about, like, do they consider a game like Manor Lords, which is a city builder type game, to be a strategy thing?
Yeah, and that's what I was getting at. is that right? Or City Skylines, you know, or something like that. Is that a strategy game by their definition? And are players who like those games going to associate them with strategy, or are they going to associate them with other things, with other of these motivations?
I don't know. I wouldn't consider City Skylines to be a strategy game, but I also wouldn't consider a game like Banished to be a strategy game either, because to me, strategy is more about unit movement and like yield placement, rather than a game like Banished, which is more like a colony simulator.
Right. But again, my whole point is that there's a very fuzzy gray area there.
Yeah.
In, you know, is there a line between strategy and management games? Right. I mean, like, heck, look at like a sports game, right? Like, you play like a franchise or dynasty mode in something like Madden, right? Like, would that be considered strategy, where you're supposedly managing a team for up to 30 years and making long-term decisions about like salaries and stuff like that, and roster changes? Like, would that be considered strategy? Would the players who love sports games and play specifically that mode, would they mark that as strategy under these motivations, or would it just fall under some other motivation?
I would say they probably, I would consider it definitely to be a strategic game if you're doing it that way. But I doubt that the survey maker was able to distinguish that, like, because they're the same game as the players who would just be playing, like, for instance, Madden. If you're playing the game yourself and not doing the strategy mode, it would be very difficult to have somebody self-report one or the other based on, oh, I just played this game.
Right.
So I would think that games like that would probably not be included in that kind of data. So they're probably right, looking at specifically strategy games and specifically games that don't have a direct play mode, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and then also one of my other favorite genres is survival horror. And remember, for years in like the mid to late 2000s and, you know, early 2000s, we were being told by, you know, all the executives in the gaming industry that survival horror is dead. No one wants to play survival horror games anymore, except those they were exploding on Steam or in indie horror games. You know, we're all over the place. We're getting very, very popular. And now we're seeing a revival of that genre as well. And specifically, we're seeing more survival horror games now that more closely resemble the classic kinds of survival horror games that were from like the late 90s and early 2000s that actually were more strategy and long-term planning focused, as opposed to just like, you know, the very, you know, twitchy, just like shootery kind of games. You know, the ones that we're getting now are a lot more strategy and management and resource management focused than, say, you know, horror games from, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, so, you know, Left 4 Dead and all the zombie things like that. But then now you have things like Project Zomboid, where you're just trying to survive.
Well, and even like the newer Resident Evil games, right? Like, you look at Resident Evil having been a smash hit. Like, that was basically a soft reboot, right, of the original Resident Evil game. That had more in common with the original Resident Evil than with like Resident Evil 4, and definitely with like Resident Evil 6. So, A, that's another example of strategy in a different genre of game. You know, that's not specifically the strategy genre, but the strategy in that genre is becoming more popular. And, you know, also B, it is an example that I'm citing because, you know, if this stat depresses you and you think strategy games are going to die, well, people said that about horror games, you know, 15 years ago. And
people said that about strategy games too.
Yeah, and horror games are doing just fine right now.
And it's been said about RPGs and everything else. It's just a cyclical thing. The whole decline of that could just be in relation, like we were saying, to people not having the mental energy necessarily to set out on an evening and play a strategy game. They might want to save it for the weekend. So they're still playing it, but maybe they're playing less of it than they used to. It doesn't mean that the whole thing's going to go out the window.
Right.
The people on the Civ Fanatics forum generally suggest that it is a, you know, reporting error thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that entirely explains it, because it is a like according to the article, strategy was like the one of motivation that saw that trend. Like everything else was kind of level, right? And strategy was the exception. So there's definitely something going on with strategy in the people who are reporting to this. The question is, what is that?
Well, and people thought city builders were dead when SimCity 2013 died, and then City Skylines showed up and basically
like the
said,
year after.
Like, oh, I think it was 2 years after. But either way, it was like, oh, hey, guess what? People do like this style of game. They just don't like what they thought, what the industry thought people liked.
Yeah, they didn't like that game.
Yeah, like you were talking about, we have this explosion of the medieval type city builders. We've had things like that before. You've had, like, if you go further back, you've had things like Caesar and the Cleopatra game, where it was antiquity and you were doing city building, but people probably thought that wasn't going to sell at the time, but it did.
Yeah, and again, it's not just the medieval city builders. It's all kinds of city builders. City the builders, medieval yeah. one is just the most prominent one. Like, there's also, you know, I've played multiple post-apocalyptic city builders over the past few years. I've seen a couple Wild West themed ones, you know. So there's some other sci-fi ones. Like I played a pretty good one called Imagine Earth. That it's not really a city builder. It is more of like a colony builder management game. But it's about
surviving
building colonies.
Mars.
Yeah, on other planets. Yeah, we got Surviving Mars.
Surviving the Aftermath.
I think there's a couple games about colonizing Mars that are available right now. But yeah, Surviving the Aftermath, which I played, which is quite good.
Oh, Prospero, which is half story and half strategy, in a sense. So, you know.
There's a new game on, I think it might be going into early access soon. I think it's called Terra Roma or something like that, which, you know, looks like another Roman like style city builder on the, you know, along the lines of something like Caesar.
Yeah, city builders aren't dead like they thought. It's just that style that you wanted to do, where, like, in particularly in that one where you had to be constantly online or you wanted to sell 10,000 different types of DLC, that style's dead. But everybody's finding new ways.
And not only that, but like those games are on consoles now too, right? Like Surviving the Aftermath, Surviving Mars. Well, I don't know about Surviving Mars, but I do know Surviving the Aftermath, that is on PS5. That's on consoles. I have two different VR town building games on my PS5. I still haven't gotten around to playing either of them yet because as limited as my game playing time is, my VR playing time is even more limited with a toddler running around. It's very hard to keep your eyes on a toddler when you've got a VR headset strapped to your face. So the fact that they're increasingly on consoles now might mean that there's also going to be more exposure and more people will be playing them on consoles. And Civ has been on consoles, right? Civ 6. How long? I think it came out first for PC, right? And then it was like a couple of years before it came out on consoles.
Yes.
But I mean, who knows? Maybe Civ 7 will see a simultaneous release on both PC and consoles.
That's the plan, according to what we've seen.
Yeah. So exposure could also be a big part of this too.
And for people who like multiplayer, if we get crossplay between the platforms from the beginning, that's also going to help boost it.
Absolutely.
Oh yes. The CRPG thing also had the same thing happen. They told us in the early 2000s it was dead, and then Baldur's Gate 3 showed up, and it's really, really popular.
Right,
and they took the time to do it right.
Yeah, all it takes is one huge game, one huge mega hit, to completely revitalize an entire genre. And the fact that we have so many companies that are making so many games means there's just more and more opportunity for one of those games to be that viral smash hit. And then suddenly every studio wants to make a turn-based, you know, grand strategy game. Just like every company wanted to make, you know, brown military shooters, you know, 15 years ago.
Now the Baldur's Gate sends some, well, everybody's trying to jump in and do that. And, well, some of them are going to do it, and some of them are going to do it bad.
And then Civ 6 is the best-selling of the Civ games, and it's the most recent. So.
And Civ 5, I think, still has a pretty sizable player base on Steam,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Civ 5 and Civ 6 are still in the top 50 players every day.
So, long story short, if you're panicked, don't panic.
Don't.
I think strategy gaming will be just fine. It's very possible that the, you know, big studio executives might see trends like this and not fund as many big budget games, but like there's so many indie games, like that's not something you need to worry about.
Yeah, I don't think big studios make RTS games anyway, or TBS games, strategy games in general. They're more busy interested in making like the big flashy games like Call of Duty and such.
Yeah, case in point, EA, where is a new Alpha Centauri game?
EA, we like to sit on all this IP we could be making games with, but we're not going to because,
I think it's a blessing.
Close down a bunch of studios. Close down a bunch of studios at the same time, yeah. Because they just recently closed down Arcane Austin, and there was like two different games they were working on. And
that's actually Microsoft.
Yeah, and Microsoft closing Tango.
Yeah.
After, you know, they released a smash hit Hi-Fi Rush, which was like won freaking Game of the Year awards and stuff.
And they were also going to be working on a Prey 2, which is the second time. It was just a totally different studio trying to do a Prey 2. So it was like, guys, quit killing things before they have a chance.
Well, we forced them to make a live service video game and it didn't turn out well, so we killed the studio.
Yeah.
That sounds really nice. Good job. Even though this studio has a history of making games like Dishonored and Prey and all these other very, very good, popular, well-regarded games. But nope, we make them make a game they're not good at, and then they don't do well at it because it's not a popular genre anyway.
It's
and
all
then
their
we close
fault,
them.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Right, or, you know, EA expecting, like, Dead Space, right, to be, like, a smash hit, you know, mega, you know, game that everyone is playing. And it's like, no, horror is a niche genre that's never going to have the kind of mass market appeal that you're looking for. And strategy is also kind of a niche genre anyway, and always has been. So, you know, it's never going to have the mass appeal of something like a Fortnite, right? That's just not going to happen unless there's some massive upheaval in like society as a whole.
Yeah.
I find that unlikely. Not the mass upheaval part, the mass upheaval into strategy gaming thing.
Well, who knows? Maybe in the not too distant future when we all have like computer chips in our brain that give us a bunch of extra memory and processing, you know, multi-threaded processing capacity, maybe we'll all be playing strategy games in the background all the time because it's something to do.
Ugh, no thank you. If I'm doing it in the background, it's not fun. Anyway, I think we've talked this topic to the point where we can move on. What do you think?
Yeah, it was a fun talk, though.
I do like this one comment that somebody had. It was, I think they got the results they did because the 4X players were too immersed in the games to take the poll.
Yeah, that too. We were too busy one more turning to one more poll.
Right. The new challenge for started back in June, going through here in July, is Terra Incognita. Still got about a week left right now as we're recording.
10 days.
Yes.
Have either of you played this one?
No, I started it the other day, but I had read through what I was supposed to do, and it started, and I'm just still kind of confused.
So the idea is, it's basically a Terra map. It's a preset map, though, so everyone gets the same map, and you play as Zhao in Prince or Hungary. What's his name? Or Venice, Matthew?
Matthias.
Matthias. You play as Hungary. Matthias, okay. You play as him if you're playing on Emperor. And you basically start out with eight or nine other civs on the same continent. So there's not a lot of space. There's almost no resources on your home continent. And the idea is you want to get to the new world and settle it and then just win a regular victory. Having played the game, some of these game parameters that are listed are not accurate. For one thing, the game is actually in epic speed, and their turn limit doesn't exist. So you basically play until you win, basically. And all the victory conditions are turned on, and the other continent is full of city-states. So you can either kill them or just use them. But I played the Zhao version, and I have not won it yet. But I have settled like 8 cities on the second continent. It's much more abundant over there than it is on the home continent. So it's an interesting challenge because you don't have the ability to go into the water until you've researched the tech. And me, being the brilliant person I am, researched astronomy first and didn't realize that you have to actually do the one that gives you the access to the water. So I was a little delayed, but it's definitely an interesting scenario. Also, you've got monopolies and corporations, which means that culture victory is pretty easy.
Did that ever get fixed so that the like AI actually properly builds improvements when that is enabled?
I believe it did.
Oh, okay, good.
Because in the game I have, there are AI improvements on the map. So.
But is that because they were like already built into the map, or because the AI actually built them?
No, because when you start out, nobody has a city yet. You get like three settlers, and you have to settle your cities, and you get a couple of builders, and you start. So no, it's not pre-built.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, cool.
Yeah, it was also the slower. I'm used to at least normal turn speed, and this was epic, and it's just like everything takes so long. Yeah, like I'm looking at the research at first and going, how many turns?
It's like 80 turns when the game started. It's ridiculous. Yeah, like,
60 turns to build a library, 50 turns to build a unit.
Well, it's also starting era is Renaissance, so everything is a little bit more expensive than you expect because the techs are a little bit further in the tech tree.
Yeah.
And you don't have cities that have had a chance to grow yet. You're starting with brand new cities, so it's going to take a while to ramp up the production so you get back to reasonable turns.
Every time I do any kind of advanced start in Civ, both Civ 5 and Civ 6, like I would have that same problem where because everything was so much more expensive to do, I would like fall behind in terms of like tech progress and stuff like that because it takes so long to get it all going.
It's a little bit more important to build builders early in that, so you can get the tile yields up quick.
Builders, traders.
Yeah. Usually builders and settlers are the best part in the early game on an advanced start. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting one. I intend to finish my Zhao run later today. Barbarians on the water are a really big problem, so you want to your starting position is one tile off the ocean, which is a good thing, but you probably want to build a harbor very early so you can build ships and actually control the barbarians. Because I sent several settlers over without naval escorts, and a good 80% of them would get captured, so I had to build boats.
Tisk tisk, Canis. Should know better.
I didn't, like the AI. I didn't realize the naval barbs would be so effective.
Yeah, well, in an advanced start, I think they're a lot more of a problem, because if you start in the ancient era, like normal, most of the barb ships that would spawn would just get destroyed by the other civs anyway, or the outposts, the coastal outposts get clobbered.
It's about the same as when I play on regular standings.
Yeah, it didn't take, maybe 5 or 6 turns, and then suddenly it does a little poof noise, and then, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 barbarian camps spawned in different parts of the Pangaea. It's like, oh, crap, here we go.
In my experience, though, a couple of privateers will easily take care of that barb problem.
Yes, but I had to tech to privateers first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying, is if you're going to carry on with that game, you know, a couple of privateers, you should be good.
Oh, I'm well past the point where barbarian ships matter, because I can just buy settlers on the New World. So,
well, for our listeners, in situations like that, if you're struggling in the same way that Canis was, privateers are really good for it because they have the ranged bombardment, which means your privateer doesn't necessarily have to take a lot of damage when it sinks barbarian ships. But also, when you find the barbarian coastal outposts that are spawning those ships, you can bombard any land unit that's on it and then use the, the raid ability of privateers to then destroy the outpost itself and also get like golden stuff from it.
So, yeah.
Privateers are great for that. You don't have to embark a land unit to go take that outpost. The privateer can do it all by itself.
I always forget about privateers.
Because they're kind of in a weird part of the tech tree, I think.
They are, and I personally think they are a very underrated unit in Civ 6 in particular. I think there's a lot of players, especially players who played Civ 4, who probably think of privateers as being crap, because in Civ 4, they were so weak that once anybody had frigates, like all the privateers became useless. and like frigates and privateers were unlocked by like the same tech, or yes. It was like one tech later or something.
They were
like
the same tech, yes.
Yeah, so you had to get that tech early in order to have privateers and then build them early before other people got that tech and built frigates. So, but in Civ 6, they're at different techs, and the privateers have multiple uses, right? They're not just used for attacking other player ships. They're great for taking on barbarians, and they're great for doing coastal raids, not just of other players and city-states, but also of barbarian outposts. And I think the coastal raid ability might even let them, if I remember correctly, you can get any lingering like goody huts that are off on like islands or whatever. Like as long as it's on the coast, I believe the privateer can also claim those.
I believe so, yes.
And they've got a ranged attack, so you can attack and sink other ships without necessarily having to take damage back, which means they survive a lot longer. They're going to get experience. They get promotions. They have very good promotions. You get gold from, like, all of the coastal raids, and, like, one of the first or second tier promotions, like, doubles the gold that you get, so they're great for, as a gold farm. If you do have a lot of, like, islands out in the fog of war in the middle of the ocean that are constantly spawning and respawning barbarian outposts. I mean, of course, obviously, with any naval unit, it depends on the map. If you're playing a Pangaea map, you're not going to get as much from privateers as if you are playing a continents or archipelago map. But
or a Terra map.
Or a Terra map, but privateers are really good in Civ 6.
They were really good in Civ 5 too, but they were just melee units.
Yeah, they were just like a regular military unit. The big thing was they could capture other ships. In Civ 6, they're really good because they have multiple utilities, and you don't have to be at war to get utility from them, because you can use them to attack barbarians and get gold, which they couldn't do in Civ 5. So as long as those barbarians aren't popping out with, like, destroyers, you're good.
Some of the reports we get from the players in the Civilization thread, or the Civ Fanatics thread, is that the AI seems to be not very good at settling cities on the other continent, and that they don't seem to be interested in building many wonders.
Because
they're usually wonder-obsessed.
Yeah, the not settling the other continent, that makes sense, because there's probably a very low flavor for that because of loyalty mechanics in Civ 6. But yeah, usually the AIs are wonder-obsessed. Like, that's weird.
I'm wondering if it's because there aren't any, like, there are very, very few resources in the old world that they just don't feel like they can.
Could also be tied to the fact that they are not as good with just naval in general.
With a Renaissance start, I think the ancient and classical wonders are, like, unavailable anyway, right? I think you can maybe build medieval wonders wonders. So, like, you're not building, like, Stonehenge, right?
I think like the wonders are gated by... No, that was Civ 4, the ones, like, they used to obsolete, I guess, in older games, but they don't now. But I know that you can't build some of the ancient era stuff, because I looked...
Yeah, you're not going to be building Stonehenge or the Colossus or anything like that. But you can, I think, build medieval wonders. The thing is, of course, they're going to be crazy expensive, right? Because we're on, epic game speed?
Yeah, when I looked at it, I was like 100 turns in and they were still like 50 turns to build.
Yeah, so that's probably what's preventing the AIs from doing it. They probably have higher prioritization on building other things. Although, that being said, I've had plenty of games... starting in the ancient era, where like an AI player with just or an AI civ with just one city so far, and like just like they're starting warrior, and maybe they built like an archer or something like that, they'll start building some wonder that'll take 40, 50 turns to build, and then they just get like owned because someone declares war on them, and they don't stop building the wonder in order to build units, and just get rolled over.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of surprised that that you don't end up with problems like that in scenarios like this, where like some AI decides it's just going to build a wonder, but that wonder is going to take 150 turns, and in the meantime, everyone declares war on them because they're a weak, easy target.
Also, if you're going to found a religion, you have to do it in the first era, because after the Renaissance, like, great prophets don't exist anymore. So a lot of the games are like, oh, one civ founded a religion, and no others can be founded. So religious victory, if you go for it early, is also pretty easy, apparently.
Ooh, Well, yeah, definitely, because then that religion is going to have absolutely no opposition, and it's just going to spread, and no one else can build missionaries, no one else can build inquisitors. Like, the only way to stop that player from winning a religious victory would be to capture their capital.
Yeah, kill them.
I guess you could, if you're at war with them, you can, your military units can kill their missionaries, and I think that kills some of the religious belief in the surrounding area, but
yes,
that only has limited effect and doesn't prevent them from just expanding their religion in other directions. Yeah, watch out for that player. If one player founds a religion, keep an eye on them. Should we go on to the next topic then?
I think so. It's our only forum topic, I believe.
Right.
Yes.
Yep. So as some of you might possibly be aware, there's a little thing called Civ 7 that has recently been announced that is just over the horizon next year, right? 2025.
Yep.
So people are now starting to get into the thick of speculation and wish lists and stuff like that, as if that wasn't happening before. But we have a post on Civ Fanatics from Krajzen. Not sure how
to pronounce
that.
Krajzen.
Krajzen? Okay.
Because it's Polish.
Things you don't want to see in Civ 7 and its expansions. And the OP doesn't suggest any themselves. They just ask the question. And the first post says, or the first response says, I hope to see fewer abilities that are overly long and focused on terrain-specific yields. I wholeheartedly agree with that. I have complained in the past about, you know, looking at a civilization's abilities and there being a wall of text, and I'm just like, eh, I don't feel like reading all that, and I don't feel like doing all that.
And the number of times you get civs that are more terrain-specific focused, like you get Canada or Russia, and then you don't get the Tundra to go with it. It's really frustrating.
Yeah, lots of re-rolling. I don't mind that so much if they've got other stuff going on with them.
Yeah.
But then again, then that comes back, circles back to the first problem of, well, now you've got a long ability with a lot of, like, you know, things going on, and it gets overly complicated, and we don't want that. So simpler abilities, I think it doesn't necessarily have to go back to being the super simple, like, one-line abilities from, like, Civ 5, but I'm sure there's, like, a happy medium in between Civ 5 and Civ 6 ability scope that I think would be a nice sweet spot. This reply also says, I'd really like to see Gandhi not return.
I'd be okay with that, so we can avoid the Gandhi nuke meme.
Yeah, I would suspect, though, that even if Gandhi isn't in the launch roster... India definitely would be, but I would suspect that Gandhi would show up at his DLC at some point.
That would
anyway.
Be fine.
But yeah, I would also not mind at all seeing a launch version of India that has a leader other than Gandhi. Or at the very least have multiple leaders, right? Like, you know, I'd like, if they're going to have multiple leaders again, like they did in Civ 6, then I would like for, at launch, there to be multiple civilizations that have multiple leaders, not just one token civilization to be like, look, we have a feature that
then,
we really didn't use at all.
Yeah, and I'd like there to be, you know, if you're going to have more than one Civ, make it more than just one per DLC.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the old school expansion pack release philosophy, where it's a pack of multiple civs and new rules and mechanics and units and all that stuff.
Oh, I definitely agree.
And then the last thing, so I agreed with the first two. The last one, not so much. This reply says, no early game nomadic phase. It specifically says that it works in humankind because it's part of the rat race to pick the first culture. So that doesn't necessarily apply to civilization. You know, not necessarily, of course, we have no idea how Civ 7 will work, so maybe it'll have something similar going on. But I do agree with that it doesn't really fit with Civ as much as humankind, because you're not, you know, you don't have that period where before you pick a culture. However, I do still think that having some kind of early nomadic period could still be a net positive in a Civilization game because it allows you to explore a little and get the lay of the land and pick an ideal spot for a city. And especially if you're going to have civs that have abilities that are tied to certain terrain, then having the buffer to be able to explore a little bit and make sure you get that terrain is valuable.
Yeah, because we have situations now where what the AI thinks is a good settling spot is things like one off the coast when you're a coastal civ. You know, I want that flexibility to move that one tile over or just, you know, adjust my position just a little bit because, like, there's a really good river with floodplains just up over there. Yeah. You know, if I take that extra turn or a turn and a half and, you know.
To be fair, though, in Civ 6 with districts, settling one or two tiles from the coast wasn't the crippling mistake it's, that it was yeah, in earlier Civs because you can still build the harbor district. It's just going to take longer and be more expensive. But I mean, yeah, like in Civ 5, Civ 4, when those coastal Civs or naval Civs would build one tile off the coast, it would just be like Picard facepalm. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, a little bit times on the early cities or the first city, I want to do that to get the sailing a little bit quicker because that was the boost for it.
There are strategic reasons for not settling directly on the coast in Civ 6, like if there's a chance that you're going to get rolled by barbarian ships.
I just don't want to be hard-locked into a weird position without having a choice, especially for my capital, because my capital is going to be doing heavy lifting for the first, you know, couple of eras.
Right. Well, and also, like, this poster says that it would kill the tension of do I settle now or risk looking for a better spot. But, like, I completely disagree, because, like, again, looking at humankind as the example, like, the whole part of that early nomadic phase is there being that constant pressure and ticking clock of you want to settle sooner rather than later, but there are multiple rewards and perks for doing more exploration, right? And building and creating more units before you settle that first city and pick your first culture. So I think there's a really good tug of war in humankind. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily translate to Civ or to Civ 7, but like having a buffer zone where it is actually realistic and viable to not just settle the first tile you're on the first turn, like creates, I think, more of that tension because now you have the leeway to explore, but there's still going to be that pressure to settle that city earlier rather than sooner. And then it's a question of, well, how long do I want to wait to find the perfect spot before I finally do settle down? And do I also risk moving away from the ideal spot and then having to spend more time circling back to found that city? Humankind kind of solves that problem by letting any unit settle an outpost. So you have multiple units exploring, so you can keep one unit around your starting area, and they actually have respawning resources that you can keep repeatedly collecting. So you can keep a unit where you started in case you do realize that, oh, that was the best place to settle. But you at least have that opportunity to look around, get a lay of the land. Like, you could even fight other players before you've started settling cities. And I like a lot of that stuff, and I would like to see that in Civ. So I understand the reasoning, but I completely disagree with this particular user's reply.
My opinion on early game nomadic phase, make it like 15 turns and don't let anybody settle before it ends. That way it's like, okay, you spend 15 turns walking around the map, and then you pick a spot, and you don't have like a settler unit, you just pick your spot. And then once you've settled your capital that way, you don't have to worry about, you would start building settlers for other cities, but at least you'd get the spot you wanted to start in.
I don't know necessarily that there should just be a hard cutoff where you have exactly 15 turns, but I do think there should be like a comfortable buffer where you don't have players that are just, where there's a really strong incentive to not just settle on the first turn. So players actually are spending 10, 15 turns exploring. And then somewhere in that 10 to 15 turn window is when it all starts happening. Because you don't want to just feel constantly pressured to settle on like the first or second turn. And now that nomadic period is like completely moot.
There'd have to be some sort of cost benefit analysis on what,
yeah,
what settling earlier could do for you. But,
and Civ 6 already has a precedent for that with the Maori civilization, so.
Yeah. Other things that are suggested here, basically don't make it like humankind where you change cultures across eras, and so a lot of people don't seem to like the culture policy system, which I don't like it, but I think it's pretty cool in terms of usefulness.
Yeah, it works pretty well for me because you can. I feel like you're a little more flexible about swapping around the direction of your civ, not just with the governments, which is what we had before, which most of that, but then having these individual policies to customize it a bit better to fit what you've got.
I like the policies. I don't like the government system. I think there should be a more robust government system.
I agree with that. I think the policies are an upgrade over. I think the policies in Civ 6 are an upgrade over the culture policy trees in Civ 5, in that you actually can change and pivot if game circumstances change and you need to. But I will point out that there's probably like half of those policy cards that I've never slotted into one of my governments. So having some more, having a wider variety of really good cards that I have to choose between would definitely help make that more interesting.
Oh, we don't need more options, substantially. We just need...
For the options that exist to be better.
I think they're all pretty good, depending on what you're looking for. I think most of the reason that I'm not good at picking culture cards, or policy cards, is that I don't think deeply strategically about when I play Civ 6 because I mostly play it as an easy game that I don't want to think too much about unless I'm like in the mood to do a really strategic game. But I hardly ever change the cards anyway, so you know.
Well, I'll also
the thing I was talking about and stuff we wanted to have it in. That there's that mod that shows you what the actual effects of the changes are going to be, like what science or what culture and stuff. That was in on that. I think people would use them more.
Oh yeah.
I was about to say, I'm going to channel my inner Phil here and say, I think what will help is better UX, where there would be a tooltip or something that would pop up that would tell you how your yields would change if you slotted in this card as opposed to another card or the one that exists.
The bottom that shows your net plus and minus from where your policy cards are now even would be great.
Yeah, not having to go back out to the map and like add everything up yourself would definitely make that less micromanagey and more, you know, just making less doing the math, more making the decision.
Right.
You want us to make interesting decisions in the game, let us have the information to make the decisions with.
I'd like to not have to watch city-state units meander aimlessly late in the game, is another reply. I would like to see the city-states be a little bit more assertive in general. I dislike that they're as passive as they are, especially in Civ 6. I'd like to see neighboring city-states actually, like, fight each other, like, on their own. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Don't want to see that, because we had that in Civ 5.
Oh, I liked it in Civ 5.
I like the city-states in Civ 5 better than I like them in Civ 6. But I also understand that the way that money works in Civ 6 would make that totally unviable in Civ 6.
It had to change for sure.
But at the same time, maybe a limit cap or unit cap for city states, like not like 2 or 3, but more like, you know, maybe they shouldn't be able to have more units than they have tiles.
Yeah, that would help. Or if there's some kind of stacking mechanic, where, you know, even if they do have multiple units, at least they can stack.
I don't want stacking units.
Yeah, because if I only had one city, I would never be able to have the size of army that the city-states have.
Because if the city-states can stack units, I want to be able to stack units. And if I'm allowed to stack units, there's problems. Because...
No, I meant broadly speaking, if they're stacking, then...
Oh.
I'm definitely not suggesting that only city-states should be able to stack units.
Okay.
Although I think there could be an argument for being able to like garrison multiple units inside of the city, and then you
arguably,
know they
yeah
right so that during peacetime they're not all just like sitting around in the field twiddling their thumbs.
Oh, but you want them on your strategic resources so they don't get pillaged by spies. Wait, that's Civ 4. Never mind.
Sure. that's not bad in Civ 6 to do either. Like especially with you know mounted units moving 4 or 5. Spaces in a turn, they could easily get in and pillage something and then get out. I usually do, as standard practice, camp defensive units on my strategic resources in Civ 6.
I want the Civ Beyond Earth diplomacy system.
Or something more like it. Yeah.
Or maybe a mixture of Six and Beyond Earth, because I played Beyond Earth again recently, and man, that diplomacy system is so much better. I don't want loyalty to come back, because I don't like the fact that...
I know they want to have some sort of a mechanic to make you have to have a maintenance cost when you come into those cities, or if they're not so easy to hold on to, but it's something different from what we have now.
Something other than, oh, you took a city at great cost, and now it's going to flip back immediately.
Yeah, that's... Blah.
Especially if it's a system that is, like, really easy to circumvent, right? By just, like, capturing multiple cities on this, like, just arranging it so that you get their health mm-hmm. down to zero, but don't capture it, then go on to, like, the two cities closest to it, get them down to zero, and then just capture them all in the same turn. Like, if it's that easy to work around that mechanic to the point that it becomes completely moot, then it's not a great mechanic.
This guy says he doesn't want the World Congress to come back. I want the Civ 5 World Congress to come back with the Civ 6 diplomacy victory point system, because I think that would be fun.
You know, we still have to have some sort of World Congress-ish thing to do a diplomatic. You know, just like we used to have the Apostolic Palace before, and the UN, and it's going to be something like that.
Somebody also said they don't want religious victory because it's too easy.
Yeah, somebody specifically calls out the religion balance because some of the tenets are just game-breakingly silly. Also, I don't know if we talked about it the other day or if this is in-game chat for multiplayer, but oh my gosh, Monumentality. As much as I love it, that needs to be nerfed if they're going to have something like that in Civ 7. Because you sit there on a bunch of faith and then suddenly you can spam out like half a continent's worth of settlers.
Here's one that says, I don't want complex leader abilities that the AI can't handle. So that circles back to the first reply we read. It's just another justification for not having overly complicated leader abilities.
It's great for us, but if the AI can't understand how to use it, then that makes them feel like a dumber opponent. And I think multiple people in here have asked for a smarter opponent.
No. And then the immediate reply to that from the OP is... more generally, please don't design the game around fundamental mechanics that the AI cannot handle.
Exactly.
Which I think is a long-standing problem now in Civilization. I think that goes back at least to Civ 4, where there are just certain rules that the AI just does not know how to use. But then again, that basically just comes from the fact that the game is complicated. And I mean, like, I don't think anyone wants Civ 7 to have the level of complexity as, like, Civ 1, even if it does mean that the AI can handle all of the rules.
I don't want small maps. I want the map size to have more hexes on it.
Yes, more hexes, especially now that cities, especially if they're going to keep a district mechanic where the cities sprawl across multiple tiles, there needs to be more open space between cities. Speaking of the map, something I would like to see is for the map to be able to wrap north-south as well as east-west.
I think it can if you set it up with certain map types.
Yeah, I mean,
Donut Planet.
Yeah, well, I specifically would like for the map to be more, have a more, you know, spherical shape. You know, where there are fewer tiles on the poles and more tiles at the equator.
That would be really hard to do.
It would be.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've seen an illustration, I don't know if it's in this thread or a different thread, of somebody showing what that would look like, where it has, I think it still has to have a few pentagons mixed in to make it work with hexes, to make it shape like a sphere. That's actually really hard to get the hexagons into a sphere and get also the AI to understand the movement.
I did play, I mentioned this one earlier, but there was a game that I played a few years ago called Imagine Earth, which is a game that, it was a colony building game on different planets, but each planet was actually spherical, and it was broken up into, I think, triangular pieces. But you had the entire planet. It was small and abstract, so these are like think Outer Wilds, you know, size planets here, where there's like a few colonies on the whole planet, and eventually like the entire surface of the planet is covered with urban sprawl. But, you know, like, I mean, that could be an option, like having, you know, playing around with different shapes of tiles and tessellations in order to be able to make the map more closely either be on a sphere or project onto a sphere more easily.
Yeah, someone else is talking about them. They want some, you know, improvements to the map generator. One of the things I've noticed in multiplayer is it has a, because this happened with some multiplayer games I've played this week, is it really loves to stick the human players together on a smaller map. And there was only myself and another human doing co-op against two AI, and it loved to put us two together. It's like, no, can I click a box that says this is co-op mode? Don't put me next to this person. Make sure we have some separation, which also partly has to do with how the map generates, because sometimes that's not possible. But at the same time, an option to say we're playing co-op, we'd like to be spread out, something. I don't know how hard it is to program.
Here's one that I like from Lord Lakely. Here's a response that I like from Lord Lakely, which says that they don't want convoluted winning conditions. So.
Oh, like how hard it was at first for all of us to understand how the heck to do culture?
Well, that's one of them as well. But I think also just in general, like having the discrete victory conditions the way they are, where you have to do one very specific thing, and then you kind of have to laser focus. I would like to see more broad victory conditions where you can accomplish them in multiple different ways without having to like be like, all my cities must specialize in science because I'm going for a science victory. And I have to commit to that fairly early on in the game. Like, I would like to see a move away from that and more towards, I do what I need to do in the here and now to grow and expand my empire. And then, you know, worry about how to win later.
Survive up until like into the Renaissance era or something like that, or a little bit later, early industrial, and then you start to think about the win condition.
You don't have to, like, science victory is mentioned in that post. It's like it's super convoluted, but it really isn't. You just have to build a district and then build some projects there. It's no different. It's a lot less complicated than in previous games having to build all the different spaceship parts.
Yeah, and I definitely also agree with this person saying that they don't like that the domination victory like requires like capturing every single capital. They propose that it should be more like you control, you know, it should be based on how much, what percentage of the map you control.
Yeah,
and I also like that better.
Bring back conquest victory and right, turn domination back to what it was in Civ 4.
Yeah, my favorite victory type of any civilization game that I've ever played was the Civ 4. Was it conquest?
Domination? Where you control a percentage of the map and population?
Right, it was like 60% of the map and 60% of the population or something like that.
I think it was 70 and 60.
And that game also had the vassalage system and the permanent alliances, and those counted towards the land area and population that you controlled. Although I think it might have raised the threshold that you needed to control in order to win. And what I liked about that was, like I was getting at before, is you could play the game however you wanted, right? The objective was just to grow and expand your empire by any means necessary. And then whoever had the, you know, when you got to a point where you were the clear, biggest, strongest empire in the game, you win. You didn't have to go through the tedium of playing through two or three extra eras just to exactly. check off a bunch of boxes.
There are times when you're not... You own literally in land 2/3 of the map. You have these huge cities, and they still want, and you still have to go like conquer 2 or 3 or more capitals or something like that. It's like you have a literal amount of domination over everything else. It's just going to happen. Don't make me slog through another 100 turns to prove that I win.
Or even if it's not based on a percentage of like the map that you control, but if it's based on like the difference between how much you control and how much the other factions control. Because if you're like 10 times, right, the size and, you know, military power of any other civ in the game, like...
We have those up there on the ribbon right now that we can see our tech rate and stuff. If I'm 10 times the next AI, or even if I'm 5 times the next AI, I think I've got this.
Right. If it's to the point where every other faction in the game would have to unite as one in order to even have the chance at toppling you, you've won the game, right? Yeah. And if they want, then make that, right, then make that a thing. Like, I've seen plenty of other strategy games where when you get that powerful, all the other factions turn against you, and then the, you know, it's like the final boss is you have to beat them all. Like, if they want to do that, fine, do that. That'll still hopefully bring the game to an end sooner than having to, you know, like I said, go and capture every one of their capitals.
And Phil's not here, but I'm sure he'd like vassalization back for that.
I think that's what I'd like to do, yeah.
Well, still, sometimes it would be nice to, I've beaten you up enough, would you like to become part of the Empire, you know, and still independently administer your section of things, you know? Come on. Because at a certain point, that's another thing in the later game, is when you have so many cities and the tedium of getting through all those cities.
And also, on the topic, a little bit tangential, don't create victory conditions that require you to do something completely different than what you've been doing for the rest of the game. I'm looking at you, Civilization Colonization, where the first 90% of the game is all trade and economics and building colonies and development.
And never prepare an army for a war against the
king. And then you reach some arbitrary threshold where suddenly you need a massive army to repel a European invasion. But, like, the whole rest of the game, you don't have to ever have a standing army at all. Mm-hmm. Like, also, don't do that. I liked colonization, but the victory condition was awful and convoluted.
I'm going to say it. I don't want districts back. I want to go back to vertical cities.
I don't know. I have a feeling that that's just going to be the standard moving forward with
I'm pretty sure it is too, but I'm still voicing my opinion that I want vertical cities back.
And there are, of course, different ways to do districts. So, you know, there might be better ways to do it than what Civ 6 did.
But when I get those plus 6 and plus 7 districts, I get a little dopamine rush.
Also, I mean, I guess if you had, like, good, like, governor assistants who actually could make decent decisions on placing districts where you could delegate that to, you know, an AI governor, you know, maybe then.
I don't want to ever delegate that to an AI governor.
No, even in previous games, and even in other games that aren't Civ, letting the AI governor try to handle something else of it.
Because tiles are so important in Civ that letting the AI say, okay, I'm going to put this district here, is just asking to be screwed over by the governor.
Well, and especially in Civ 6, where that's permanent,
yeah,
and you cannot change it. Like, no, at least with, like, an improvement, right? Like, if you have your builders automated, right, like, and they build something in, like, the wrong place, you can send another builder, demolish it, and build something, you know, build what you want to build. And, you know, if you have a situation where that's like 1 in 10 tiles, well, then maybe automating that is worth it, right? And then just occasionally having to step in and manually correct something. But if it's a permanent thing that you cannot change, then that's problematic.
Yeah.
If our borders are still going to grow by individual tiles via our culture, I want to be able to direct which tiles to pick up. Because so many times I've gone in there and looked and said, oh, you're going to get this strategic resource tile in 5 turns. I'm like, okay, well, then I won't buy it. You know, I'll just have the worker go, you know, head over there. And then when it goes to pick the tile, it picks like this random grassland over here I don't need. It's like, told me you were picking this tile. Why did you pick the grassland? It's like it changes whatever AI is controlling it, like changes its mind at the last minute. You know, so the interface lies to me and tells me it's going to do that. Now I have to buy the tile anyway. Let me pick
designate.
Yeah, focus control or something like that. Like, tell it to prioritize strategic when they pop up. And then you can go back to, like, food or whatever.
Here's someone who's actually suggesting that the policy card idea might be better suited to religion rather than government.
Religions don't tend to change their tenets very often.
No.
They specifically cite divides between Protestantism and Catholicism and, you know, Shia and Sunni as examples of, like, what they're talking about.
Yes, but in situations like that, it's not like when the Protestants broke away from the Catholics changed their tenets.
Right. Yeah. No, that was the entire point was that there was then conflict between them.
Yeah, there's no reason to have that level of like, we don't have religious schisms in the game, which is what those were. And we don't really need them because you can just found your own religion. I mean, yeah, it would be, it's like, that sounds like an EU4 kind of thing rather than a Civ thing. Uh-oh. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, you're here.
Yes.
Okay, thank goodness. Somebody.
I was just reading more posts.
Yeah, somebody suggested the future era in general and global warming specifically needs to be implemented differently so that the AI can actually understand that it needs to mitigate it.
Yeah, because it's too easy for you to have gotten to a good tech level and you start your own thing. You start converting from coal to oil and then oil to nuclear, get your hydroelectric and your solar in, and you're cleaning up your act, and the AI is just exploding out everywhere, and they don't seem to realize. They don't know that this is...
They don't care.
Yeah, they don't know, and they don't care, and then they blame you. That's the other part. Because you polluted some early on, but now it's all your fault.
I think I would also like to see more, like, technologies or sciences that, like, aren't, you know, real technologies or science in the modern sense. Like, I would really like to see alchemy be, like, a tech, you know, a medieval tech or a classical era tech in Civ.
Oh, you want to have the steampunk kind of techs or
no,
something?
No, not even necessarily that, but just, like, alchemy, like, as a stepping stone to more modern chemistry, you know, where, you know, like, maybe you research alchemy early in the game and, like, you're able to start getting, like, you know, medicines and stuff like that. That, you know, they're not particularly effective, and then later that leads to actual chemistry and actual medicine that give you, you know, more useful stuff.
I think it's already represented by some of the other techs.
Maybe.
Because in Civ, we have a bunch of techs that are very specific, but it's not like all the other technologies that aren't listed aren't also discovered in the game. So I would say specific techs are less important than the concepts they convey. Like, because when we don't have a tech for railroads anymore. It's called steam power. Well, that doesn't mean we didn't also develop railroads and such. The techs are abstracted, and I think there's been a movement in the last few games to reduce the number of total techs. Although Civ 6 is a little different because it has the culture policies, or the culture tree as well, which kind of divides the number.
Yeah, there's basically two tech trees in Civ 6.
Yeah, but as a general rule, we don't need a tech for every specific little thing. Alchemy is a cool idea, but it's just chemistry, really. I mean, we call it alchemy because they were trying things that weren't possible, but that doesn't mean they weren't trying chemistry.
Right, but in the meantime, they also developed, you know, standards of measurements and, you know, experimentation and all the stuff that did lead directly into the scientific revolution and scientific method.
Yeah, but that's already represented by things in the tech tree. Like, education covers a lot of that.
Yeah, perhaps.
And in a game like Civ, where there is a very specific limit to the number of technologies you have, some things just have to make the cut. Especially since Civ has a standard game limit of 500 turns. There's only so much you can put in a single game. I don't want builder charges back. I want workers, because workers are better.
I agree that workers are better, but I actually do like that you have to continually reinvest production into your rural development.
Yeah, that is going to be heckin' expensive.
I think that's something that you and I might have to just agree to disagree on.
That's possible.
I think that's a personal preference kind of thing. Now, I would definitely have... I would definitely leave the door open for, you know, there to potentially be another way of handling rural development. Like, maybe it's not even a unit at all.
I wouldn't like that.
Right. Or maybe there's, like, a more generic civilian unit that's, like, a builder and a settler, you know, and other things, too. I remember the Civilization board game, I think, has a kind of interesting way of approaching that, where you basically have two different types of units. There's armies, and then there's I think the game called them scouts. But basically, your scout is an exploration unit, but it's also the unit that you, it's also your settler, it's also the unit that you use to build new cities. But also, if you put it on a tile or on a resource, it lets you send that yield back to one of your cities each turn. So it's also like, you know, I would compare it, I called it like the cowboy in the game when I was doing that. So, you know, maybe having like a general purpose civilian unit could be an interesting way to go. I don't know if any of that makes sense. I don't know if I'm explaining my idea the way I'm imagining it in my head. I will say that I am frustrated with not being able to like build my own like roads.
Yes.
And I think that that was the biggest casualty of the transition from workers to builders, right? Because building roads would require a crap ton of charges, but then, right, that would probably make builders too strong because they would have to have so many charges that you'd be able to do too many things with them. I don't have an objection in principle to, like, trade units creating roads as they travel, because that actually, I think, is a pretty realistic mechanic. But, like, armies also use roads. And, you know, non-merchant civilians traveled along roads. Like, roads existed for other reasons besides just trade. And yeah. Civilization VI doesn't quite, like, get that.
I don't like that early era units don't use the roads to increase their speed.
Yeah, that's a problem too.
Yeah, the thing we have now in Civ 6 with the traders creating the roads is because of the advantage to the international trade routes, you have a lot of roads going out of your empire, and then you're left with no infrastructure inside your empire, which seems backwards to the way it would usually start.
Right, unless you are either playing as Rome or you are explicitly sending a lot. Well, I mean, I do send a lot of domestic trade routes, you know, especially to new cities. But what happens a lot of times is my first few cities don't have roads going between them because I don't have that many trader units left.
Yes.
Right? Because the one trader unit that I have is getting...
I need that to balance the book so I don't go bankrupt.
Right, yeah. It's going to a city state or another civ to get gold. So I've got a nice, big, pretty road going from my capital to some other player's capital, but then no roads going to my other cities. And then, of course, when Montezuma forward settles me and declares war on me, and I've got to get all my armies to those other cities.
Across a bunch of hills.
Right, yeah, exactly. I don't know, maybe all units should just be able, all military units should just be able to build roads, like the Legion.
Special Rome.
Cutting out a bit necky.
And it's kind of funny that Rome has the ability, the innate ability, that there's automatically roads between their cities, but then they also have a unique military unit that builds roads, which almost kind of feels redundant, because at that point you don't need it as much.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, pick one. Either the Legions build the roads or they get auto roads.
Yeah, the designers were like, well, we definitely want to make sure that Rome has roads.
Has roads.
Every Roman thing is going to have roads.
Because we have that saying about all the roads lead to Rome. We must make it happen.
Which, of course, was not literal.
Yeah.
Or not meant to be taken literal. It probably was literal as well. But, you know, that's what happens when you have a city that is the seat of, you know, an, at the time, world-spanning empire. Okay, well, I think we actually ended up talking more about things we want to see and not as much about things we don't want to see.
I think it was a pretty good mix.
Well, they go hand in hand. Sometimes you can't talk about the things you don't want without talking about the things you do want.
Oh my goodness, we went way over time.
Yeah, we were kind of short, and then suddenly we get onto this topic, and it's like, let me tell you all those things I don't like. And we can do that for hours, apparently.
Yep, mega episode.
Ooh, bonus. So this has been episode 436 of Polycast. I'm Makalua, and with me today, Candace Albinus.
One of these days, we'll learn how to do it in the proper amount of time, but until then, enjoy the extra content.
Hey, it's tradition to go extra long, Ask Dan. And also Mega Bears Band.
Alright, I should probably go take a nap now. And by nap, I probably mean I'll actually just play more Cities Skylines 2.
I might try the actual nap, personally. But have fun.
I think I'm going to play Civ 6.
Hey, also a good plan.
But it depends on what Liza wants. My poor cat has been a little bit upset with me for the last couple of weeks because I haven't been home as much.
And then also the past couple of few days, traumatized by the fireworks.
Oh yeah, people shooting off fireworks until 1 in the morning. Like, I get it. America is great, and I love that I live in America, but you have to be setting off explosives at 11:30 at night.
I hate fireworks because I live in Las Vegas, and every year many houses in the valley catch fire because people are irresponsibly lighting off fireworks. So I personally despise them because I think they're too much of a liability. But that is because I live in a very arid, dry climate.
Yeah, we don't have that kind of problem here, mostly because it rained a lot this week. So we didn't have any fires, thank goodness. But I can totally understand that problem. Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright the Polycast at thepolycast.net.